See our brother Mark, and on the screen, I think you would have the topic. So, brother Mark.
My dear brothers and sisters in Christ, just before we get into this, it occurred to me this morning when brother Morgan was going over the responsibilities that we will have as elders and deacons, I believe the word is, in the ecclesia. Is of such importance that we really need to keep thinking about the list as it was portrayed in that master list that he presented. And I actually thought so much of that list that I went up and took a picture of it because I wanted to get that organized in a way that I can utilize it. But if you may remember that one of the things on the list was bishops or deacons or both, I think, need to know how to keep their wives and their children in subjection in all things. So when that carries over into the ecclesia, that particular attribute of experience gives us the responsibility of helping our young people in our ecclesia understand that they are in subjection to a creator, whose will they are subject to, whether or not they believe in him. And so, you know, our experience at home then, once we've gained it and we have, by reason of use, a certain level of spiritual maturity, carries over into the ecclesia and gives us the sense that we need to communicate with our children the more important part of their subjection to their Father in heaven. And that's what brings up a subject like this, because this is one area where young people are being bombarded in every aspect of science, falsely so-called in school in some cases, which is trying to convince them intrinsically that there is no God by removing God from the creation and saying, in effect, we made ourselves. And, of course, we know the psalmist says, it is he that hath made us, and not we ourselves. The simplest way the psalmist shows us that evolution is wrong, among so many others in scriptures. I show this to the teens when I go around because I know they're dealing with this in their minds. Their decision to be baptized will be predicated in some part upon their understanding that they were created by God instead of by accident. So it's our job to show them some of the things that will be presented in this series tonight. You may have noticed that the title is The Origin of Species, and no, that's not misspelled. Because that's what we're going to be looking at a little bit more than the origin of species. We'll get into the meaning as we go. And that would be the difference between spontaneous and rebellious generation. So you may be wondering, well, what's this? Well, this is what our children's heads will evolve into if we keep letting them play video games and do nothing but tap on their phones and their computers. They'll turn into machines eventually, at least according to the theory of evolution. So let's get our definitions straight first. We have a few words that we're going to be tossing around tonight. One is specious, spontaneous, rebellious, and evolution. I'd like to go over this with you in some depth. And in that, what we will attempt to do is understand the difference between a spontaneous generation, or rather spontaneous generation, and a rebellious generation. So what's spontaneous generation? Well, the scientific term, the technical term, is abiogenesis. It's a noun, and it means the supposed development of living organisms from non-living matter, also called autogenesis or spontaneous generation. For example, what that theory says is that people came from gas, that living matter came from non-living matter. You know, if you think about it, it's sort of more like the reverse, isn't it? That's what I'm talking about. I didn't want to say it, but Jeff just went ahead and did me a favor. I wasn't sure when I thought about it my mother would ever want to hear this on a tape of mine. So I said, well, I'll get it there, just, you know, I'll just make a little allusion to it and everybody. But Jeff felt like we needed to be sure we understood exactly what this point was. That's right. The reverse, Jeff. Thank you very much. You can always count on a friend. So here's early spontaneous generation. Aristotle said explicitly taught, Aristotle explicitly taught abiogenesis and laid it down as an observed fact that some animals spring from putrid matter, that plant life, lice, arise from the dew which falls on plants, and that fleas are developed from putrid matter. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? But this is early spontaneous generation. Alexander Ross, an intellectual of his time, said of his opponent, probably a creationist, or if not that, just an honest doubter, he said, so may he doubt whether in cheese and timber worms are generated, or if beetles and wasps in cow's dung, or if butterflies, locusts, grasshoppers, shellfish, snails, eels, flies, and such like be procreated of putrefied matter, which is apt to receive the form of that creature to which it is by formative power disposed? To question this is to question reason, sense, and experience. If he doubts of this, let him go to Egypt. Yeah, that's what we say, isn't it? Let him go to Egypt. That's where you get the truth. And there he will find... That's where they went, isn't it? We're trying to get out of Egypt, not go into Egypt. But anyway, and there he will find... No, come on. And there he will find the fields swarming with mice begot of the mud of Nilus, to the great calamity of the inhabitants. So, that's what Alexander Ross said in the early years of spontaneous generation. And then in my research, I ran across old recipes for spontaneous generation. Here's a recipe for bees if you want to sort of cook some up evolutionarily. Kill a young bull and bury it in an upright position so that its horns protrude from the ground. After a month, a swarm of bees will fly out of the corpse. Bada boom, bada bing. That's what they say, that's what my people say back in Sicily. And then there's Jean-Baptiste van Helmont's recipe for mice. Place a dirty shirt or some rags in an open pot or barrel containing a few grains of wheat or some wheat bran. And in 21 days, how does this guy get so specific with this? You know he didn't do it. Where's he getting the 21 days from? I don't know, but in 21 days, mice will appear. There will be adult males and females present, and they will be capable of mating and producing more mice.
If you put a buffet table out, Christadelphians will appear.
Thank you again, Brother Jeff. We're on the same wavelength here. Is he talking about dirty laundry there? I don't know, but what he's talking about is not something I'm very familiar with. So let's just take a look at the reality of all this. This is a fly's face. And it's a photomicrograph. I wish I could tell you to what power. I love photomicrography because it just lets you get a look at things you otherwise would never see, or perhaps would not be unwilling to swat, but would certainly never see. Nobody wants to look at a fly, especially if this is his mouth in the face or whatever these are. But these are his eyes. And you know, you've seen illustrations of what a fly might see, this multiple image. But I just want you to notice one thing. Though he may be balding, he has nevertheless combed his hair. So we see in this a high level of order and something which we would have a hard time imagining would spring out of filthy rags, so to speak. I do believe that's where these theory come from, isn't it? These filthy rags. But anyway, so that's the fly. So here's what we know about spontaneous generation. It's impossible! I think we learned that in science class, didn't we? It is impossible. So what then would rebellious generation be in light of what spontaneous generation is under, or rebellious, let's let the Bible answer the question. Rebellious generation is a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit or mental disposition was not faithful to God. And as they say in the humanist manifesto, if God's not going to save us, we have to save ourselves. So humanists and evolutionists, when the two go hand in hand, believe that we must have faith in man because there is no God. So what do these two have to do with each other? Well, spontaneous generation, as we've already noted, as you learned in science class, is impossible. A rebellious generation thinks it came from spontaneous generation. So that's what they have to do with each other, as you can see. Let's look at the word specious now for a moment. What is specious? Something maybe... Don't ask me how I picked this. This illustration to demonstrate specious. But it was the best that I could find among all the options that I had. These are the definitions. Having the ring of truth or plausibility, but is actually fallacious or a specious argument. It's deceptively attractive. There's something about it that really kind of gets you going. You may not really realize what it is, but it's something you kind of want. You want to believe this. It's deceptively attractive. There's a usage note. A specious argument is not simply a false one, but one that has the ring of truth. If the fallaciousness is apparent, then the argument was probably not plausible in the first place, or sounding to begin with. So, plausible sounding to begin with. So it has this deceptive quality about it. So what then is the origin of specious? Well, in simple terms, it's a rebellious generation which originates a deceptively attractive theory that has the ring of truth, but is actually full of fallacy. What is a specious theory? So what is the specious theory? The theory that teaches that all life came from spontaneous generation. And of course, as we know, in more serious terms, the theory of evolution was formalized in this book, The Origin of Species, by Charles Darwin. So let's have a look at evolution here. What is evolution? Well, oops. There's two kinds, and one kind is pretty much what we can experience, and the other kind is stretching it, but one is used to justify the other, to teach the other. There's macroevolution. It's a naturally occurring beneficial change that produces increasing and inheritable complexity to the extent that species change over time. The implication is that all life came from non-living matter. How that's the implication, I'm not sure I could explain to you, but there are many people who think they can. Microevolution, on the other hand, is something that we can all recognize as being a part of the world we live in. It involves minor alterations or changes in size, shape, and color. The implications is that species so change. Well, here's an illustration of the difference between the two. This is macroevolution. So you would start with a lizard or a reptile, and then over time there would be changes so significant and complex as to produce species changes until finally this lizard evolves into a bird. All right, so that's macroevolution. Microevolution shows that a lizard can become a colored lizard, a lizard that has different colors, like a blue tail or a brown lizard. Or in some places, the lizard might be smaller or bigger. And we have terrible lizards and little teeny little lizards. And so we see in microevolution that there can be lateral changes, but we'd be hard-pressed to prove. This we can prove by experience, by observation. They're still looking for some kind of proof of this in any kind of experience or observation. So what's specious about it? The theory assumes that there is no God. How is that deceptively attractive? Well, you and I know the benefits of believing that there are no God to the flesh. This is very, very appealing. And it allows them to live what they refer to as an exuberant lifestyle, a lifestyle that allows them to indulge the flesh. And that is very, very attractive to human nature. So the thought that there is no God is the same thought that there are no commandments, that there is no law. And the thought that there is no law is very appealing to people, to fools who say there is no God and prefer lawlessness to morals. Very attractive. And that makes it deceptively appealing. And then the other side to this is that the theory uses microevolution, which is possible, recognizably possible. They use that as the true side to sell the false side, to validate macroevolution and therefore spontaneous generation. But both macroevolution and spontaneous generation are impossible. So let's now go down to a basic question. Let's put the world on trial and get some experts in here to answer some questions for us. Did the impossible happen? What would you suppose, if you were a scientific expert, you would be moved to say in the answer to that question? Well, this is what some have said. Sir Julian Huxley said the impossible happened. He said no serious scientist would deny that evolution has occurred, just as he would not deny the fact that the Earth goes around the sun. Huh? So you're saying that the orbit of the Earth around the sun shows that people came from gas? Well, that's one expert. Let's take a look at some others. Biologist Ernst Haeckel felt that the impossible had to have happened because of the option. He claimed that spontaneous generation must be true because otherwise it would be necessary to believe in a creator. Well, you can follow his reasoning. And since we know we don't want to believe in a creator, well, then the impossible must have happened. I mean, what other explanation would you offer? These are intelligent, well-known men. George Wald, the winner of the 1967 Nobel Peace Prize in science, of all things, this thing that takes its name because of the knowledge we're supposed to have acquired, said this: when it comes to the origin of life on this earth, there are only two possibilities. Now, he's limiting it to two: creation or spontaneous generation. That is evolution. There is no third way. Now, I want you to hold that thought as we go through the next few slides. There is no third way, he said. This is the Nobel Peace Prize in science winner. Spontaneous generation was disproved 100 years ago. All right, so he's being honest about it now. But that leads us to only one other conclusion, that of supernatural creation. We cannot accept that on philosophical grounds, that is for personal reasons. Therefore, we choose to believe the impossible, that life arose spontaneously by chance. So we can't accept that there's a creator or supernatural creation, you know, for whatever personal reasons we may have, or philosophical. Therefore, the impossible happened. That's what this scientist tells us. We choose to believe the impossible, he says. No, it's still impossible, isn't it? Just because we don't understand how there's a supernatural creation doesn't mean that means that the impossible happened, I don't think. So there is one third way that's been offered to the world. I agree with you. This is funny. But they're serious when they tell us about it in the upper echelons of scientific research. Here's where this comes from. You may have already recognized where we're going here. Sir Fred Hoyle was known as the father of modern chemistry. Well, he got to thinking about the probability of life forming on Earth from hydrogen, methane, and ammonia, and calculated the odds that the functional proteins necessary for life might form in one place by random events to be 10 to the 40,000. That's a 1 followed by 40,000 zeros. You mathematicians out there, you'll be impressed by the size of that number, because there are only about 10 to the 80 atoms in the entire universe. So, I mean, I'm not sure I understand how they arrive at that, but nevertheless, in terms of physics, this is what we call impossible. So he concluded life could not have originated here on Earth. He says, and being honest, he says, nor does it look as though biological evolution can be explained from within an Earthbound theory of life. Genes, he said, from outside the Earth are needed to drive the evolutionary process. In other words, something that was already living had to have floated like a spore throughout the frozen regions of space and through time and all that distance and settled down into our atmospheric stew, soup where they combined to then begin the evolutionary process. So, evolutionists are currently saying that you came from something like bacteria. Bacteria. Well, take your pick. Which one do you think you came from? Staphylococci? Streptococci? Bacilli? Spirilla? I don't know. I've met some people I thought did evolve from bacteria, but I don't want to talk about them. So you're saying we came from Mars? No, we're germs that came from Mars. That's kind of interesting. I'd just like to stop for a moment and let us consider the subject of life on Mars, scientifically. But with the better form of scientific testing, that is, by observation, let us now look at life on Mars. This is Mars. This is life. Okay, let's go over this again. This is alive. This is dead. You can see that it's dead if you look at it. One more time now. Life. Death. Got it? That works for me. Okay, the whole thing falls down. So NASA, this is where this comes from. NASA discovers life on Mars. There was a press release on August 7th, 1996, where they said a NASA research team of scientists at the Johnson Space Center and at Stanford University has found evidence that strongly suggests, here it is, the meteorite and so on, that primitive life may have existed on Mars more than 3.6 billion years ago. The NASA-funded team found the first organic molecules thought to be of Martian origin, several mineral features characteristic of biological activity, and possible microscopic fossils of primitive bacteria-like organisms inside of an ancient Martian rock that fell to Earth as a meteorite. All right, so this is a picture of what they say looks like the early forms of life, these simple forms of life on Mars. And why do they say that? Well, you remember this picture back here. Well, I'm not going to go all the way back there. But you remember that we saw some pictures of bacteria, and they're sort of capsule-shaped like that, okay? So they see a little formation in a rock, in a meteorite, and they think that some little bacteria got inside some kind of mineral compound and series of geologic processes that allowed that mineral, that bacteria, to get petrified, like Mark Twain's Petrified Man, and then preserved to even survive this event that produced a meteorite to come from Mars and then land in the Arctic, I think it was. So this is what they saw. On Earth, you have things like this in magnetite crystal chains. And on Mars, you had this kind of little thing. You see how kind of the curve is kind of the same, and there's a bunch of little dots? Well, you know what the headline went out to say? Life on Mars. That's scientific? I don't know. To some, according to organic evolution, this is how you got here. Your origin is impossible, but it happened. You're an animal descended from Martians. Let's go for some real science here. There's another little interesting thing. Everybody knows that there's a moon out there, don't you? We've all seen it. Comes up, it's pretty, and it shines in the sky, and it goes through its phases. Pretty regular, too. No matter how many months we have, that old moon just keeps on going around. Well, how would you go about, if you were a scientist, explaining the existence of the moon? This is an interesting proposition, because if you were to raise the question, where did the moon come from, the answer gets a little interesting, because it had to come from someplace, didn't it? So it either they suggest that it either came in and was captured into the orbit of the Earth as a heavenly body that or a meteor that came in, a large meteor, and was captured some time ago into the orbit of the Earth. Well, that doesn't work because its mass is too large. If it had gotten that close, it wouldn't have been captured in the orbit. This is provable with physics. It would have crashed into the Earth. All right, so that we rule that out. The other option is that somehow or another, through some other kind of meteor collision, a chunk of the Earth was knocked off, and it rose and then got captured into the orbit of the Earth and eventually wound up being round. But that won't work either, because it's too big to have been taken from the Earth and leave the Earth in the shape that it currently is in. So one NASA scientist said, well, there's a simple explanation to that. The moon isn't there. You know, you want to stand there and you want, you know, seriously and pitifully, you want to go, you know, I don't think the emperor has any clothes on here. The emperor's got no clothes. And I don't mean to take a mocking tone, but when reasonable-minded people who believe in God look at the claims of fools, because the fool has said in his heart that there is no God, you know, you either laugh or you cry, don't you? Because it's just as seriously pitiful and brazenly rebellious against God as it is funny when we look at the lighter side of our points here. But let me say that in conversations with evolutionists, I wouldn't take a mocking tone. I would be as respectful as I could, understanding that it just may not have dawned on them yet that there is reason to believe in a creator. So we have to remember, you know, this is in-house, okay? So we still have to remember to be respectful. Somebody put this poem in an evolution book. As I was sitting in my chair, I knew it had no bottom there, no, nor legs nor back, but I just sat ignoring little things like that. Point made. Now let's look at we've been looking at the ideas of abiogenesis. Let's look at biogenesis. Biogenesis is a biological principle that we are certain about because we have empirical observation of it in science. And that is that all life comes from life. This is a truth that needs no argument in the world in which we live. We recognize this is to be a biblical fact as well. All evidence confirms this fact, and there is nothing even beginning to suggest the contrary. Going back to the Bible's description of biogenesis, then God said, "Let the land produce plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds." All right, so there's seed, and trees bear fruit with the seed according to their kinds, so that life can continue to be produced from life. So God created man in his own image. Now, this is another dimension of life coming from life, because the origin of the life of man and all the other life on the earth, even if you go back to the starting point, still, according to the Bible, fulfills the law of biogenesis in saying that the life on earth came from life in heaven. So you have this principle fulfilled in this, that God created man in his own image, with his own life, or with the promise eventually of his own life, earnest mortality being only an earnest of everlasting life. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. So the origin of the life as we understand it is by the law of life. It's a law, just like the law of gravity or any other law of physics. This is a law of biology, and it's a law that is referred to as biogenesis. So let's look at the simple cell now for a little bit. I don't know if any of you have ever gotten into a close look at what a cell looks like, but it's an astonishing thing. This is the cell, the cytoplasm, the nucleus, and the outer membrane of the cell, just in any kind of cell. And then this is a cross-section of little squares. So these are those little squares blown up. And if you look at this, you start to see a complexity that is rather mind-boggling, just in the illustration of the parts as they are organized. As a matter of fact, they don't look all that biological. You could be confused and think that they were a view of a city, like the view out there that you get from the top of the mountain we went up to today on the cable car. As we went up to the top, we looked down and we saw cities and neighborhoods that kind of look like that from such a distance upward. So there really is no such thing as a simple cell. They almost have an inconceivable level of specific, complexity. This is the same series of rectangles, a little closer. It's a closer look, and you can see the organization. Let's take a closer look still. This is one of those rectangles, and you begin to see geometric patterns and all kinds of sophisticated routes and connections almost like a closed circuit, a printed circuit board, or some kind of computer chip or something. It's so sophisticated, this so-called simple cell. You know, it was bad enough in the world when pneumono ultramicroscopic silico-volcanoconiosis was the longest word anybody knew. Well, then I was reading along and all these things, and I came upon... All right, let's read this together. Now, I wish I could put some little yellow squares up there so we could identify something, but this is the word. This is one word. It's the name of a tryptophan synthetase A protein, 1,913 letter enzyme with 267 amino acids, and that's the only way they can name this enzyme. Was that, they can't even make a name of one of these parts. Simple, let alone the cell. This is what cells look like in a muscle fiber, and this is, looks to me more like the Death Star, and we're going in with, and we're going to have a little battle in there with our starships. It's an extraordinary looking, sophisticated thing. This is the diagram of a protein function in bacteria. See, if you look at a simple cell then, like a bacteria, and you look at the diagram explaining how it operates or its components and their relationship to one another and function, there's one basic question you have to ask. This is information. We live in the information age, and we know that information comes from intelligence. So in these simple cells, where did all this information come from? We know where it came from. Would anybody suggest that this Pratt and Whitney jet engine just happened by chance? This is a limited slip transmission differential. So you look in this, and this is a little simpler looking to me than the simple cell. Would anybody suggest that just happened? Can you tell what this is? Does anybody recognize this? You know what this is? This is the motor inside the flagellum that the bacteria uses to swim as he moves himself around in your body fluids. This is actually a motor that is a biologic motor. It's called the bacterial flagellum, and it's how bacteria move. You saw a close-up of it. The flagellum waves around and propels the bacteria. Let's listen to this. Oops, wait a minute.
Bacteria used to swim through liquids.
Let's start that again.
A flagellum is literally an outboard motor that bacteria used to swim through liquids. And again, it's literally, it's not an analogy. The flagellum has a propeller. Mm-hmm. And the propeller is hooked onto a motor by something called hook protein. Essentially, it's the nut that holds it on. Mm-hmm. And the motor, which turns the flagellum is powered by a rotary motor, one of two that are known in nature. Mm-hmm. The motor uses a flow of acid from the inside of the bacteria to the outside to power this turning. And there's a part called the stator, which keeps the whole machine in place while it's turning in the cell. And altogether, genetic studies have shown that 50 different protein parts are required for the flagellum to work. The flagellum is a really magnificent example of irreducible complexity, of a molecular machine, and of the argument for intelligent design.
All right, so that's just a little bit. I'd like to go into that a little bit, but I'm going to spare you the time. This is a white blood cell. It actually finds and eats bacteria. Here's a little bacteria, and this is a photomicrograph of a white blood cell eating a bacteria. So what Dr. Walter Brown says of this, if the many instructions that direct an animal's immune system were not already programmed into the organism's genetic system when it first appeared, the first of thousands of potential infections would have destroyed the organism, nullifying any rare genetic improvements that might have accumulated. In other words, the large amount of genetic information covering the immune system could not have accumulated in a slow evolutionary sense. So that shows you how another example of irreducible complexity, But the wonder of all these so-called simple things going on inside us all the time that are not simple at all, because there is a creator with a mind so vast that it's so far above us, who can know it? This photomicrograph is another one that always attracted me, because as you get into these so-called simple realms, you look, for example, at how a spider ejects the web out of his spinnerets. This is a close-up photograph of the mechanism on a spider's bottom that actually does that. It's astonishing. And they can, it's not just this, but they can eject, I think, four different types of line, depending on the purpose, whether they want to drop or have a bug stick or build a web or whatever. So spider spinnerets are just a marvel, and you can see with your eyes the complexity, the irreducible complexity, that God has put inside the creation. Small doesn't mean simple. These are viruses. Look at that. This is what viruses look like. They look like machines when you look at them closely. This is a picture of what a virus does to attack a cell. They land on the cell, they inject the cell, and plant a substance that breaks down the cell and grows new viruses. The cell then bursts and all these viruses get released in your body, and you then know what happens after that. But this looks like a sci-fi movie to me. And these look like machines, not biologic organisms. There's nothing simple about it. And you think, can this be real? Well, these are actual pictures of those cells, those phage viruses that you just saw. Another example of a cell under attack. These are actual photographs. Just pointing out that can actually happen. Now, just a couple more slides here and we'll close. Let's land on this kind of understanding of life as being inconceivably intricate, with so much information that the information had to come from somewhere. That somewhere is the mind of God. There are millions of components in one cell. If written on a tape, each cell would be 7 feet long. There are 30 trillion cells in your body. If each 7-foot tape were hooked together, they would stretch to the moon and back 100,000 times. If all the information contained in these cells, this is the cells of one body, were reduced to a printed material, the volumes would fill the Grand Canyon to overflowing 40 times. That's how much information is in your body. And that for me goes way past beautifully and wonderfully made. And if beautifully and wonderfully made describes that, then beautiful and wonderful are things that we are just beginning to conceive, and we will know in full one day in the kingdom. So the ultimate creation of eternal life is certainly not impossible for the creator of so much living intricacy. What you're looking here is a scanning tunneling microscope photograph, or it's a photo representation of an actual gene, or excuse me, a DNA strand. And this is where the information for our bodies is, as you well know. This information is spoken of in language that describes it as being written. The code inside DNA is a written code. It's a writable code. Yours is unique and mine is unique. Everything that makes us up, in other words, from DNA, can be written. It may be that your name, written in the Book of Life, has this information in it. So that no matter what happened to you in the past, eaten by a lion, burned at the stake, or died of natural causes and buried in the ground and long since turned to dust, if God has the information about you, He can rewrite you. He can make a copy. There's a copy in every DNA strand. He can make another copy of you. And everything that made you up, including your thoughts and your personalities and your memories, your very identity, can be written again. Now, that may be what's contained in the Book of Life. Wouldn't want that blotted out for a little self-indulgence, would we? Bottom line is, in the end, something we all hope for dearly. Everlasting life will produce like kind.